Good morning and welcome to Lambda Weekly, the world's longest running gay and lesbian radio show for the whole family. I'm David Taffet and I'm here in the studio with Ron Landis and Patty Fink. And our guest today is Alice Murray. She's the executive director of the Dallas Holocaust Museum. And the reason we invited Alice here today is because we have a new exhibit at the Holocaust Museum that we're installing. And when I say we, I mean yesterday I was physically unloading boxes. We have a new exhibit at the Holocaust Museum called Nazi Persecution of Homosexuals from 1933 to 1945. What a delightful topic for early in the morning.
We'll make it good.
Good morning, Alice. Thank you
good
for
morning.
Coming.
Good morning. Thank you, Dave.
Tell us a little bit about the Holocaust Museum itself, the Dallas Holocaust Museum. Most people don't even know that we have one.
That's so sad.
It is.
It really is sad. But it's true. We recognize that there's a lot of people that don't know. Almost all children know because we host so many students, like 18,000 students come to over 350 different schools, bring their whole classes, usually in middle school. But the history of the museum starts back in 1984 when the survivors who were getting to know each other. We had 450-some survivors in the Dallas area at that point in time, and they wanted to know each other. And they also wanted, they realized that they were telling stories and they were starting to be recognized as the voice of what happened in the Holocaust. So they realized that if they put together an exhibit at the Jewish Community Center, people and especially teachers could bring students to actually see photographs and remnants of what they had brought back with them. So in 1984, the JCC gave them permission to have an area in the lower level, and they put together their photographs. They had all sorts of artifacts that they had collected on their own. So that happened, and almost immediately, one of that group of founders, who was Mike Jacobs, went to Europe, and he managed to talk the Belgium government out of a boxcar. It was the first one in the United States. Quite amazing when we think about it now that 27 years ago, he had this foresight to say, we need to show, people need to actually see what it was that we were carried around on in Europe to the deaths of so many, of 6 million people. And the Belgian government handed him a bill for $850 and said, you know, this is the cost of the boxcar. And he said, are you serious? You're going to charge me for this boxcar that transported my whole family to their deaths and 6 million other people? You're going to charge me $850? How do you put a price on a boxcar? And he shamed them into giving him the boxcar, and they called and got the shipping covered too by the shipping company. So we received the boxcar for nothing in 1984, and that really started the exhibit.
What I find amazing about it also is it's not just that we had this exhibit here in Dallas, but in 1984 that was one of the first Holocaust exhibits in the United States. The U.S. Holocaust Museum didn't organize until the 1990s.
Much later, that's right. Much later.
And other cities, like New York, has a lot more Holocaust survivors. Didn't have a Holocaust Museum. Chicago didn't have anything like this until later.
So. Oh, Chicago has a huge population of Holocaust survivors and a huge Jewish population alone. And it wasn't until the skinhead thing happened in Skokie that they decided they really needed to have a museum. And they just opened it 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. And so Dallas was way ahead of its time. Now, it was 20 years in the J as an exhibit with the boxcar. I mean, you walked through the boxcar to get into the photographs and exhibit. So it wasn't until 2000, 7 years ago, what is that? 2004. That they moved downtown. They had the presence of mind to realize they were too small. They were getting more and more large groups of students, and they didn't have room to do it, and they really needed to think about what they needed to do next. And that's when they decided being downtown instead of in the Jewish community was the way to reach the non-Jewish part of the world, and that's really what we do. And in fact, 99% of the students who come in are not Jewish.
Is our museum the only one of its kind in Texas?
No. We have a museum in Houston, a large museum in Houston, in the Arts District and the Cultural District. And there's a museum in San Antonio, and there's one in El Paso.
Oh.
We're the second largest.
We're cutting edge here.
Yeah.
In Texas.
Oh, yes. And when we build our new museum, we'll be larger than Houston, and we'll be the biggest museum in Texas, although they have plans to outdo
us.
We
can't let Houston be bigger.
But did you hear? They have plans to outdo that.
Houston,
it's a back and forth.
Yeah, Houston has a plan. Ours will be a 50,000-foot museum, and they already have plans on the board for a 100,000-foot museum. So we'll only be big for a certain period of time, probably a few years, because that's a big jump.
That is.
Yeah.
So in 1984, there were the group that started the museum and the exhibit had enough artifacts and photographs and such to obviously spawn a visitor site. Mm-hmm. Is that true today, or most of the things that are in the museum, are they from survivors who
actually, yes,
originally
they mostly
performed?
Are. What happened, Patty, when they decided to be a real museum, because at that point in time they were a center for memorial studies, and it was a lot about the history and photographs that they could get from Yad Vashem, which is the official museum of the Holocaust in Israel, in Jerusalem. And they're very giving with their photographs. And they set up a historical educational experience. But when they moved downtown, they designed a museum. And it is stunning. They picked a theme, which is to pick one day, and the only museum in the world that picked one day of the Holocaust. And we have an exhibit all around April 19th, 1943.
Oh, how interesting.
It is very interesting, and it's something that the teachers can really teach in a very effective way in kids, which is our prime audience, because it's in middle school. We really want to reach them, and that's when they really are affected the most, when they hear the stories. And so this one day, they can remember that. There are three amazing things that happened on April 19th, and it was really brilliant of the curator that came up with that concept. And the designer did this fantastic. It's a very moving and dynamic exhibit, because the walls are sort of at angles, so you feel the movement. It's very, you feel it pressing down on you, and you feel it opening up again. It's sort of dark, but yet there's a wonderful story of rescue in the first vignette about three Belgium young men who rescued a train on the way to Auschwitz and successfully got 230 Jews off of the boxcars. And the second vignette is a wonderful story of revolt, the story of the Warsaw Ghetto uprising. And that just gives you such hope. I mean, if you were standing there on April 19th, 1943, you would have hope. You would see these three young Belgian men who really cared enough and were upstanders and who really did the right thing. And then you would see these thousands and thousands of young Jewish men in the Warsaw Ghetto that were revolting against, you know, armies of Nazis, and fought them off for 30 days with smuggled weapons. And then the third vignette is not so uplifting, because it's about a conference in Bermuda where American and British leaders came together to discuss whether there was a thing going on in Europe that was really brutalizing and killing Jews, and they felt they didn't have enough proof of that, so they played some golf and they all went back to their respective countries and did nothing, so that wasn't so uplifting. But it's an exhibit where you can, there are lots of artifacts, there are uniforms from Auschwitz, there are barbed wire, there's hair, there's, you know, the glass frames, there's incredible photographs, the stories. We have 2 hours of audio guide that take you through that experience, and you come out through a memorial room that has stones and prayers, and the walls are covered in engraved stones of the people who were lost in the Holocaust by their families here in Dallas.
Well, you know, I think it's interesting, before we begin talking about the exhibit that's here now, I think for context, I think a lot of our listeners would appreciate understanding some of the history about the Jewish community, particularly in North Texas, but in Texas at large. Now, I went to Baylor, which is the largest Southern Baptist university in the world. We used to call it Jerusalem on the Brazos. You know, and yet Waco, where Baylor resides, it was founded by a very large Jewish community, as was Dallas, as was Galveston, as for lots of others in Houston.
Allen brothers from Brooklyn.
Exactly. Exactly. So it was the Jewish community who founded these great Texas cities.
Mm-hmm. I didn't even
and
know that.
And so to you know, have this museum in Dallas now, I think that's really extraordinary. And then to have this exhibit that we're going to talk about, mm-hmm. there as well. I think it's just really wonderful history. It's very rich. Very rich history we have here in Texas.
It is. It is. And I'm so pleased that you knew that. It's the more people understand the Jewish community, whether it's through the Holocaust or through their traditions, it's such a rich, rich history.
And such a relatively small population.
Yes, yes, like 50,000 Jews in the Dallas-Fort Worth area out of about 6 million. They have a loud voice, really, if you think about it.
Well, we have 309 million people now in the United States.
Sorry, I'm laughing because when you said they have a loud voice, my eyes are bright today.
I was just going to say, I've never been known as a loudmouth. okay, so here's the history of this exhibit coming in. I had seen this thing online about this exhibit called Nazi Persecution of Homosexuals, 1933 to 1945. It's a traveling exhibit that was done by the U.S. Holocaust Museum. And I became friendly, and I'm saying me and Beth Elbana, the gay and lesbian synagogue in Oak Lawn, became friendly with the Holocaust Museum last July when our friend Fred Phelps came to visit. We talked about this on the air, but for people who weren't listening because we weren't on in the mornings, Fred Phelps is the one who... demonstrates against the military funerals.
Everything.
Yeah, I can say well, pretty everything. Much anything.
This week it's Joplin, Missouri. So he came to demonstrate against our synagogue and the Holocaust
but
Museum.
But he's actually been around for the gay community, so no, much
years,
longer.
For years.
Yeah.
He protested at Matthew Shepard's
funeral
in the late 90s.
Yes.
And so
that's when he really became famous.
Right, and we've really known him a lot longer than since he started protesting military funerals.
So the Holocaust Museum and the Jewish community, they were kind of horrified by this. The gay community thought it was time for a party.
And a fundraiser.
And we did. In 1 hour, outside the AIDS Resource Center, which is where Beth Elbana meets, we raised $11,000 in 1 hour, and we used it to buy things like an ice maker that the AIDS Resource Center needed for its hot meals program. So we bought this ice maker and still had money left over. It's called the Fred Phelps Memorial Ice Maker with a big plaque on it. And
because that's what we do. Somebody, I think it was in somewhere in Kansas, actually, came up with the idea early on to say for every minute they protest, they actually protest, we're going to have pledges for each minute. So the longer they protest, the more the fundraiser gained. So... it was in everyone's best interest, and I'm sure it just crawls all over the Reverend Phelps that, the longer they stand there doing their thing.
And if it didn't, I took a picture of the ice maker and sent it to Fred, thanked him for his appearance, and sent a list of other things that we needed and asked when he was coming back. And he has not set foot in Texas
since.
Hope
it wasn't taken as an
I was going to say, has he replied yet?
He did not reply, but he did, in that he hasn't set foot in Texas since.
Yeah,
and he has been all over, and he normally would come to Texas twice a year.
Can I say that was an amazing day for the museum because the gay lesbian community was so supportive. We had fought this for 6 weeks. We knew for 2 months that they were coming, and we didn't want to make a media event out of it. So as people, but it went viral. It went viral because of you guys, probably. But it went viral in Facebook on Dee's blog. And thousands of people were, let's all gather at the museum because that's the first place they were going to come. And we thought that we needed to really soften and completely diffuse that because we didn't want to make them the media event of the day. So we opened the museum for free. We said, if you do come, please come in the exhibit. Let them be the only ones out in the 100-degree heat on July 9th. And the gay lesbian community showed up in hundreds and hundreds, but it was beautiful because it wasn't planned. We weren't encouraging it, and we did have all of our docents on hand, and people came in. In fact, when what I call the creepy people, when they left, the lines of people who were mostly the gay lesbian community lined up, literally waited to come through the museum because we can only fit about 100 at a time in the exhibit part, and there were probably 400. And they waited
in
line.
Down the steps, around the corner.
Oh, with their dogs, they had, of course, they had their own what do you call it, banners?
Counter signs, yeah.
Yeah, signs. You know, if the creepy people were saying all the hatred that they had for everybody, especially Jews and Holocaust people and gay lesbians, but they were on the Jewish warpath in mm-hmm. front of the museum, so the gay lesbian community had signs like, well, my mother hates apple pie. Or we love lollipops. I mean, they were just this, as silly a sign as their hateful signs were silly. And put it in context, it was a beautiful day.
Now, I forgot, were you, David, did you actually interview one or two of the Phelps Clan? Or did somebody?
No, somebody did, and I was close enough to Shirley to really see. What I found frightening about her was that in person, she wasn't this monster. She was almost a sane person. And I found that more disconcerting than anything.
And for those who don't know, we're talking about a very small group of people.
Oh, it was 12. It was 12, yes.
Yeah, so 12. It was yeah. four. I think it was only four adults.
Right.
It's four adults and eight children, yeah. eight ranging from 3 years old to 14 years old.
You know, I didn't know they had one that small.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, that's sad.
It's
yeah.
one family, really, that,
yeah.
that populates this church.
Yes.
Westboro Baptist Church. Mm-hmm. Yes. When we went to the Millennial March in Washington in 2000, there was a big event at the RFK stadium mm-hmm. at that time, and they were, you know, all out in front, you know, yelling at us and, you know, all of this stuff, and a bunch of us went by and said, we'll pray for you, and they stopped. They didn't know what to say to that. They had to think for a minute, I guess.
So church, after all.
It was interesting.
Yeah, and what was interesting about that day was, you know, when the Phelps people protest, it's usually not related to anything, has nothing to do, you know, they're just non sequiturs that they put together. This very much related to the Holocaust. One of the Holocaust survivors was inside, and the museum had asked all the survivors, just stay home, you don't need to look at this garbage. And what he said was, I've seen a lot worse in my day. If that's the best they can do, you know, that's just, you know,
that's,
don't worry
it in
about
perspective.
It.
That, yeah.
That's just
yeah.
so lame.
And what a perfect way to feel about this, because I was out in the street. One of the police officers was ready to belt Shirley in the face. I mean, he was ready to he was incensed. I think it was the one that said, your rabbi is a whore, that sign. He didn't care for that. I thought it was funny. I took a picture. We enlarged it, gave it to our rabbi.
Oh. Your sense of humor.
But, don't you love it?
but he was incensed by that, and I held him back, me holding a police officer back, because I said that's what they're looking for. They want to turn
yeah.
around and then sue.
Sue you, yeah. yeah.
But what they were doing was really the same tactics that started the Holocaust. The Holocaust very much started with bullying.
Yes.
And that's
taunting.
What they're doing, and taunting.
Yes. Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that. We need to take a break in about a minute, but
well, we'll start with the idea that Hitler and the Nazi regime really wanted power. They wanted control, so they spread the propaganda of hating Jews and picked out Jews as the group that they needed to get out of their way. And that hatred was what they used to expand their forces against Judaism and make an excuse for them having the power and the control and fixing the country, because we'll get the group out of the way that's causing all the harm. So it was about propaganda and control.
Which is very much what Phelps does or started doing with, well, let's do that with gay people. They're the cause of everything bad.
Yeah. And as I say before many times on this show over the years, we have the power to cause earthquakes and, you know, massive fires and
yes.
hurricanes and tornadoes. You know, we have the power to destroy civilization as we know it. Mm-hmm. So we're told. So, you know, I guess they should pay attention.
Yeah, yeah. So, why don't we take a break?
Be afraid. Be very afraid.
Be very afraid of us, yeah. You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON-FM. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with Patty Fink and Laurent Landis. And Alice Murray is with us. She's the executive director of the Dallas Holocaust Museum. We'll be back with more right after this.
KNON thanks you for your pledge to our recent pledge drive. Now's the time to make your pledge count. Send your pledge to KNON, P.O. Box 710909. Dallas, Texas, 75371. If you missed our pledge drive, you can still support community radio by pledging on the web at knon.org. Your pledge only counts if you pay it. KNON, Box 710909, Dallas, Texas, 75371. Be sure to put the name of the show you're supporting on the check, money order, or the envelope. Questions about KNON's pledge drive, call 214-828-9500, extension 234.
This Saturday night, KNON is proud to present a rare blues treat for the Dallas-Fort Worth blues people. Big Bill Morganfield, the son of blues legend Muddy Waters. Big Bill Morganfield carries on the legacy of Muddy Waters while laying down one of his own. His first Dallas appearance is this Saturday night, and it's your chance to witness Metroplex blues history as Big Bill is joined by one of North Texas' hottest rising stars, Jason Elmore and Hoodoo Witch. The treats don't stop with the music. Chef Ivan from the Alligator Cafe will be providing his incredible Southern barbecue spread for your eating pleasure. Barbecue is included with the price of a ticket. Jason Elmore opens the show with an acoustic set this Saturday night, June 4th, at Port David's Pub in Dallas. Tickets are available now at KNON.org, Bill's Records, and Forever Young in Grand Prairie. If you only see one blues show this year, make it Big Bill Morganfield this Saturday night at Port David's Pub in Dallas. You don't want to miss this.
Is it something that you see?
89.3 KNON FM HD1 in Dallas and Fort Worth, the voice of the people.
Alrighty, today is the first day of the start of Gay Pride Month, and if you're looking for something to wear to let everyone know that you're proud, check out Old Navy, who just launched a line of Rainbow Pride themed t-shirts this week. I don't know if any company's ever done that before. Major company. No, yeah, so that's pretty interesting. Is she on, Dave? There you go.
Launch a line. We're so on again, off again with Target.
I think we're off again right now. The t-shirts will have a rainbow flag on it, and they'll have different messages that include, like, Love Proudly and Pride 2011. And all, well, not all of them, but 10% of the proceeds from these t-shirts go to the It Gets Better project. So they're doing something good. In more clothing retail news, Miley Cyrus, a.k.a. Anna Montana, is apparently a friend of our community. I never thought I would mention her name on the show.
I'm shocked.
I'm shocked. But anyway, the singer-actress has taken aim at Urban Outfitters after it was revealed that retailer's president, Richard Haynes, made contributions to right-wing Republican former Senator Rick Santorum and his political action committee. So Cyrus tweeted, quote, "Love that everybody's heading on Urban Outfitters. Every time you give them money, you help finance a campaign against gay equality," end quote. Good for her.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Who knew?
Who knew? Openly gay actress Jane Lynch won an Emmy last year for her portrayal of the sharp-tongued coach Sue Sylvester on the hit show Glee, and now she's been chosen to host this year's Emmys. That's going to be fun.
Oh, yeah. Now that will be delightful.
Yes.
That's mm-hmm. cool. What a great idea.
Jane said that she was in awe of Jimmy Fallon's performance when he hosted it last year, so she's going to use him as a model when she does it. She also said that she'll talk about her coming out in her upcoming memoir, Happy Accidents, which lands on bookshelves on September 13th. So that should be a fun read also. And last, Primetime Propaganda. That's the title of a new book by right-wing author Ben Shapiro. It's being released today, and it claims that among a lot of crazy things, that the Sesame Street's puppets brainwash kids, and the antics of these puppets promote civil disobedience. He particularly takes aim with Sesame Street's supposedly pro-gay stance when they, quote, "try to tackle divorce, tackled peaceful conflict resolution in the aftermath of 9/11, yet they had Neil Patrick Harris on the show playing subtly named fairy shoe person." Now, I didn't know anything about this. I never knew that Neil Patrick Harris was even on the show, but this is brainwashing kids into being gay.
Does Gabrielle watch Sesame Street?
She just started, actually. Yes.
You know, Elmo and Big Bird. Yeah.
I ruined her.
You just ruined her for life.
Actually, what's really going to ruin her, she just discovered also, what's the the purple dinosaur.
Oh, Barney.
Barney.
No, that won't ruin her. That's going
to
ruin you.
Your life is going to change.
You will not get that dumb song out of your head for the rest of your life.
I was, you know, she was turning the station where you caught it on, and it's like crack for kids. I mean, they just stopped.
That's bad. She's 2 years old.
I know.
She knows how to change the...
She does. And she just stopped, and she was just, like, hypnotized. I was like, oh, no. So, there we go.
Well, you introduce her to a keyboard and a computer maybe when she's 3.
Oh, no, she already does.
Oh, she's going.
She loves
well,
that.
Never mind.
Loves that. I can't keep
I
her off the keyboard.
But,
it's not too early.
No, these kids are advanced these days.
And this is Lambda Weekly, and we are talking today to Alice Murray. She is the executive director of the Dallas Holocaust Museum. A new exhibit is coming into town. It is
Nazi persecution of homosexuals from 1933 to 1945.
Came in from the U.S. Holocaust Museum, and it opens on Friday. Grand opening will be on the...
June 16th.
In the evening. Everybody invited.
But it's open to the public right now as of Friday.
As
and it's
Friday.
7 days a week, by the way. We're open every day till 5 o'clock. Monday through Friday, we open at 9:30. And Saturday and Sunday, we open at 11 a.m.
Okay.
So starting Friday, you can come anytime until forever.
Now, a lot of people don't realize that, if they don't know a lot about the Holocaust, don't realize that the Nazis were after a lot of people. They hated a lot of people.
No, that's right.
You know, there were a lot of people who suffered in the...
That's why this exhibit, we hope that it does bring attention to the lesser-known discriminatory acts of theirs. Mm-hmm. But in addition to the Jews, which the numbers are in the millions, 6 million Jews, but there were 5 million other people killed by Hitler's regime, by the Nazi regime, between 1933, mostly between 1939 and 1945 for the homosexuals. But it was homosexuals, the Roma, mm-hmm. which back then they called them gypsies,
uh-huh.
and the mentally and physically disabled mm-hmm. were in that group. The Jehovah's Witnesses were also, you know, homosexuals had to wear the pink diamond. Jehovah's Witnesses had to wear a purple diamond, and the Jewish people had to wear the yellow Star of David, and they had to... homosexuals, almost immediately when Hitler came into power, which is January of 1933 that he was made chancellor, he was rewriting all the laws, and that's when he rewrote the laws, especially paragraph 175, that had started in 1860 and 1880 was when paragraph 175 was first written. So he re-enhanced that law and made it even more onerous, and allowed the police and the Gestapo and the SS to arrest homosexuals even for looking. Simple looking was written into the law. Simple looking and simple touching was part of the law.
I was reading part of the exhibit. We unpacked it yesterday and started putting it together. So I was reading little pieces as we were putting them together. And there was one piece that said... he rewrote the law so that there were those who were born homosexuals, those who had become homosexuals, and something else.
They probably thought about being homosexual someday.
Something.
It didn't have to be any proof.
There was different punishments for the different groups.
Yes.
That were there.
Yes.
Yeah.
They actually had to go before a jurist. So the rate of conviction was around 50%. So they were arresting very, very quickly. But there were around 100,000 homosexuals that were convicted mm-hmm. of homosexuality, mm-hmm. and they were either sent to prison. Mostly when the war broke out, the ones who were in prison all that time for being homosexual were sent to concentration camps. And in many ways, they were... the history shows that they were... treated even worse than Jews, if it's possible. They were segregated from the rest of the population as homosexual population in the concentration camps, and they were given the harder labor. In many cases, they were sent to a quarry, the Brücken quarry, that was almost set up just for them to work. And it was carrying stones, heavy, heavy stones, from sometimes just from one pile to another and back. Just to keep them busy for 14 to 18 hours a day. So the punishment was well beyond the imagination because they would just look for ways to taunt, to terrorize, to torture homosexuals. Mm-hmm. The numbers were much, much smaller. And we don't know for sure how many perished in the concentration camps, but it was, they think, between 5 and 15,000. That pales in comparison to 6 million Jews, but the population was much smaller too. So they did try to eradicate the homosexual population. And by the way, mostly, Patty, I don't want you to feel left out, but it was mostly homosexual men, because they still were under the ideology that women bore children, and they wanted the German race to be, you know, propagated. So they didn't ever arrest lesbians. It was always homosexual men.
Mm-hmm. You know what I found really stunning, and it's only because I've watched a lot of History Channel and documentaries and such. But you know, in Hitler's history of coming to power, he tried the putsch, where he tried to overthrow the government, and he got thrown in prison. So he writes his silly biography.
Mein Kampf, yeah.
And then they've since found a sequel to that, which I thought was very interesting. But then when he did come to power as chancellor, he thought, well, I'm going to just do it the way everybody else does. I'm going to get voted in, which is really scary.
Yeah.
Within a week, the persecution began.
A week, that's right.
Within a week of his taking office.
And
really stunning.
And within a week, all the laws were being rewritten, that not just paragraph 175, of course, but they closed all the bars that had any indecency, decadency. And, of course, the cabarets had gained quite a lot of popularity before he came into power. So it was an abrupt shutoff and censoring of everything. They as you know, they pulled all the books out of all the bookstores and libraries and burned them if they had any sexual content or Judaism content whatsoever. They were all burned at the burning of the books in 1938, which was years later, but they were already confiscating books and making laws that Jews could no longer go to school. I mean, this happened immediately.
It was
in
like
1933. Overnight.
It was okay
Jews
to hate
school.
Jews.
You couldn't be a doctor. You couldn't be a lawyer if you were Jewish. You couldn't practice being an artist or a musician. I mean, you were not to be part of the rest of society. If you were homosexual or if you were Jewish, it must have been just a night and day difference to think all of a sudden you're not allowed to be with your friends who you've grown up with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's frightening. Mm-hmm. It's frightening. And the thing is, it can happen again if we let it.
Well, if you'll allow me, that we talk a lot. The reason that we really exist is to talk about what we need to do to make sure it doesn't happen again. And a lot of that is about memory. That's why our dear, dear survivors still come into the museum every single day and speak to the students and speak to the adults over and over again, because they know in order for us to remember, they must remember. How painful is that for them to relive losing their entire families, being starved almost to the brink of death, barely surviving at all, and the guilt of feeling like, why did I survive? Why did everybody else die? And they have to repeat that story every single day so that we remember. It's really, I feel so guilty asking them to do this, but that's what we have to do, because what happened to them was about a lot of bystanders. And they're teaching the kids today, the students today, the adults today, being a bystander is just as harmful as being a perpetrator. You are just as guilty of killing my family as a bystander when you said, it's not my problem because I'm not Jewish. It's not my problem because I'm not homosexual. You were a bystander, and you allowed them to come into power, and then once they had that, there was no stopping them. So you have to be an upstander. That's our mission in life at the Dallas Holocaust Museum. Be an upstander. Take action. The kids get it right away, because within a few seconds of me asking them, talking a little bit about being a bystander, I said, what do you think an upstander should do? What is an upstander? Because it's not a dictionary word. Mm-hmm. And they all raised their hands very quickly and said, you need to speak up. You need to do the right thing. They almost always say, do the right thing. Mm-hmm. You know, you need to see what somebody's doing. No, it's not right. Whether you know the person they're picking on or harassing or not, you need to be the one that goes and gets help and gets rid of that person, be it a bully, be it just a hate monger, that gets rid of that element. And they get it. They go, wow. I said, if you're grown up enough to be at the Holocaust Museum, you now have a grown-up responsibility to be an upstander.
And they get that, right?
They get that.
That's awesome.
Yeah, they write lots of letters to our survivors, to us, and say, wow, that changed, it really changed my life. I don't ever say I hate my mom anymore.
Wow.
They say, wow, that's really progress. And their moms are like, wow, you don't hate me? That's great. But they do. They write the letters and say, what was I thinking to say I hate my brother, I hate my sister? I never even use that word anymore. It has such terrible connotations of what it brought with it when I saw what happened in the Holocaust.
Hmm. Wow. Because it does have a, it does impact other people around them.
It does.
You know, and they
it does.
And the
it's
earlier
not just,
they get
yeah.
that.
It's not just about their friends. I said, this is what, when you're really an upstander, you're standing up for somebody you've never met before. You don't know who they are, but you know that there's no reason for someone to treat them badly. And that's about being, one of my survivors always says, we're all part of the same race, mm-hmm. the human race, so you have to stand up for each other. This is what is causing the problems all around the world. And when this, and when the students think that they're insulated from that because they're in America, I said, you're not insulated from it at all. And countries that you care about, now that you are so involved in social media and the internet, people in Africa, people in China, they're just as close to you as the man that's standing next to you. So you have to care about all of humanity. Mm-hmm. So it's not just about being in your classroom or being on your playground or being on the street. It's about listening to the news and seeing something you care about and writing letters about it. Be an upstander about people who are not being treated correctly, not mm-hmm. being treated with love and respect that they deserve. And they go, wow. I say, it's not just about standing next to somebody. It's about seeing it and seeing it's happening on the other side of the world. You can impact things now. You mm-hmm. have the opportunity and the resource to impact the world, not just your own school.
Yeah, and reaching out around the world just takes milliseconds.
Yes.
If that.
Yes.
Sometimes faster, depending
yes.
on your connection.
Well, and an issue that's been going on here in Texas and around the country is bullying. And the Holocaust began with a lot of bullying.
Oh, absolutely.
And I've heard one of the Holocaust survivors use those words exactly. And we just did pass anti-bullying legislation here in Texas. It passed
Yay.
The Senate unanimously. Yay is right. I had the chance to go down to a lobby day where people were lobbying for the anti-bullying legislation. And I was following around the kids from Youth First Texas. And they were great. And it was 10 kids. Each of them had attempted suicide.
No.
And they went into Florence Shapiro's office, and she's the senator from Plano. So three kids from Plano High looked her in the eye and told her their story. One of them said he went into the bathroom. He was beaten up. Because he's gay, and when he went to the principal's office, the principal said he brought it on himself. That will now be illegal. That principal could be thrown out for doing that.
Oh, that's so great.
Yeah, he was wonderful telling his story, and it passed the Senate unanimously. These kids were so effective. I mean, there were other people who were lobbying who were, yes, I'd like you to support Senate Bill, Wendy Davis's bill. And, you know, these kids were, I was in my school and this is what happened to me.
Wow.
And they were great. And how can you not support that?
Yeah, that's really something for Texans to be proud of, because an anti-bullying bill that is a law, that you can say our state is one of the earliest states to do this. And now there's requirements. Every school, every public school, will be required. I guess they can only control public schools. Right?
I guess, yeah.
You know, but they will be required to have policies about how to react, how to respond to a bullying situation, and how to respond to the teachers that allow it to happen. Wow. I mean, that to me will help a lot, because they no longer can stand by. It'll be against the law to stand by and be a bystander.
Well, and it includes some training for teachers and administrators on what to do.
Yeah, go ahead, Patty.
Oh, I was just going to say, often, I don't think a lot of people realize that if these were adults treating each other this way in the workplace, where you spend the majority of your day like kids do in school, there would be lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit, because there are laws in place where you
yeah.
can't have a hostile environment to work in.
Right.
And then why would we expect anything less for our children in their work day, which is a school day, so that they can navigate their day freely and, you know, focus on what X equals, you know, 2X to Y or whatever, and get their algebra homework, instead of how am I going to dash to my next classroom without getting smacked?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's sort of a complicated and problem. We, at the Dallas Holocaust Museum, we're coming up with a program where we're sort of venturing with a woman who created a program called Stand By Me, and we're going to use the Upstander program, combine it with Stand By Me. She has tried it out in one of the schools in Terrell, and what it really focuses on the not the bully, because that's a dangerous, you don't want to teach children necessarily how to approach a bully, but instead they go through training, 45 minutes to an hour makes them an upstander. They have to be clean for 6 weeks, which means they can't have any school incidents on their record before they can be an official upstander. Then they get to wear a hall pass around their neck so that if they are late to class because they were intervening in a situation, they're excused. Hmm. But it's measurable. They can see where in the school the bullying took place, but they're taught to go into the situation and extricate the victim. So they don't do anything with the bully. They leave behind a calling card that says, be an upstander. You know, you don't have to be a bully. Join our group. And they just either hand it to the person, but they tell the victim, they said, let me walk you to your next class. Let me walk you to your to the cafeteria or whatever. But they pull them out of that situation, and then they record it, and they get others to, by leaving their calling card behind, to be an upstander. They hope to create a whole school full of upstanders, and that seems to be, it's working in Terrell, and so we're going to roll that out here in Dallas this next fall when school starts again.
That's amazing and exciting.
We need to take a break. We're talking to Alice Murray. She's the executive director of the Dallas Holocaust Museum. We'll be back with more right after this.
KNON 89.3 FM is broadcasting Democracy Now!, a national daily radio news program covering today's news and issues. Democracy Now! Is hosted by Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez, broadcast worldwide on over 900 stations, pioneering the largest community media collaboration in the country. Democracy Now! Can be heard on KNON Mondays through Thursdays from 8 to 9 a.m. Not the same old news heard everywhere else. It's news of the people for the people. Democracy Now! Monday through Thursday mornings at 8 a.m. on KNON 89.3 FM.
Dallas Voice, a Texas LGBT media company, has covered news, entertainment, culture, and opinion in the North Texas LGBT community for more than 25 years. Every week, Dallas Voice reaches more than 45,000 North Texas LGBT readers in print. DallasVoice.com informs more than 170,000 visitors every month, with breaking news appearing throughout the day, every day in the Instant Tea blog. Dallas Voice is proud to support KNON Community Radio.
You're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM HD1 in Dallas and Fort Worth, the voice of the people.
And welcome back to Lambda Weekly. I'm David Taffet here in the studio with Patty Fink, and we are talking to Alice Murray. She's the president and CEO of the Dallas Holocaust Museum. Patty, during the break, you were just asking...
Yeah, we're just talking about the other aspects that the museum carries with it. And one of them is that it might be a great place for scholars to come and study.
To learn.
And to learn more about the Holocaust. And I don't know if you have oral histories of survivors who are
We do.
Available?
We have all of our survivors' testimonies on tape. In fact, right now we're engrossed in a project to digitize all of them. We've gotten the first half granted through... That actually, most of it's through the Jewish Federation, and we're getting all of our videos digitized so that they never deteriorate. So this is a good thing. When we recently expanded, which is what allowed us to have this new exhibit, the Nazi Persecution of Homosexuals, is in a new special exhibit gallery. And when we opened that, we at the same time expanded our offices so we could move out of that gallery and into another office. And when we did that, we opened a library. So we were able to finally unbox boxes and boxes of I think it's 1,400 volumes of Holocaust literature and books, and a whole section of archives that you also have as a member of the museum. You have access to the archives and to the library. We also we sponsor anywhere from 9 to 12 workshops every year where you can come in and learn. We have several different subjects. One of them is, in fact, about bullying. One is about Judaism and learning what the differences are in religious studies and a lot about different subjects and curricula on the Holocaust. But yes, we teach. We bring in special guests and speakers. We have one coming in September. I don't know if I have the right date there, that a scholar from Yad Vashem in Israel, and he comes in every year and teaches one of our workshops, and it's a profound experience if you can sign up for one of those opportunities. And as a member, you get all of this information. But we teach 300 to 600 teachers a year how to teach the Holocaust, but any citizen can come in that's a member and learn more about the Holocaust if they want to pick from the subjects that we have in our curriculum.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I know we'll do this probably again at the end in a few minutes, but can you tell us where the museum is, how you become a member?
Yes, I think I can remember. It's we're in the West End, and it's right really near the sixth floor museum, which most everybody in Texas and Dallas especially knows, off of Dealey Plaza. We're on Record Street, one block east of Houston, at the same place in the block as the sixth floor museum. So Record is right between Houston and Market Street, right in the West End. It doesn't have very good signage, but it's this beautiful historic building with arched brick windows, and it's right on Dart. So if you get off in the West End stop, you just really walk a few yards west of the stop, and you're at the Dallas Holocaust Museum.
Oh, awesome.
Yes.
Awesome. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. Very convenient. How do you become a member?
You can be a member for as little as $36. Really, if you're a teacher, it's for as little as $18. So for $36, you can go online, www.dallasholocaustmuseum.org, and you can sign up online. You can pay by credit card online, or you can call and we'll take your credit card. But the memberships range from $36 to infinitum, $25,000. Anything over $500 is considered our Circle of Remembrance members, and they get a lot of special benefits and free to all of our events and programming. But we have parking, because we own a parking lot just catty corner on Houston Street, right next to the sixth floor, and you can park there for free if you're a member, which is handy. You can actually use it for other things when you come down to eat in the West End. So just being a member pays for that, you know, that parking. It's a very big benefit of ours.
So you've got everybody covered if they come by train or by car.
Yes, and we have reciprocal. We're part of the association that allows for reciprocal museum memberships. So it's reciprocated by, I wish I knew this number, but thousands of museums across the United States, including the DMA and many big museums in Texas. So a $36 membership. No, I think it's a $108 membership that gets you the reciprocal memberships.
Right. Yeah. Very cool. Very cool.
Now, the exhibit that you have that's coming, it's called Nazi Persecution of Homosexuals, 1933 to 1945. We were talking a little bit. I had found this exhibit online, and because of this friendship that we developed on Fred Phelps Day, I was talking to them and said, hey, do you have any interest in this? And they said, you know, that's been on our list, but if you think there's some interest, you know, we need to raise a little bit of money. And I said, no problem, I have some people who will raise the money for us. And they actually did a good job within just a few weeks. The sponsors are Texas Instruments and several other companies that stepped
Jay
forward.
J. Oppenheimer and Waldman Brothers, and I wish I had this in front of me, Raytheon. Yes, thank you very much for that. It completely underwrote all of our expenses for this exhibit, and it will be there for 3 months, and they will be our special guests at the June 16th opening party. And all members are invited to that opening party, by the way, the opening reception, where the curator will be on hand to discuss it. So do go online at the DallasHolocaustMuseum.org and become a member, because you should be at that opening event.
Yeah. You know, one of the things about this particular group that was persecuted during the Holocaust that's different than all of the others is it has to do with this paragraph 175, which was this German law. Now, after the Holocaust, the concentration camps were liberated. People were, even if they had no place to go, they were at least not locked in the concentration camp. They were finally fed and whatever. But the gay people who were in the concentration camps were rearrested under paragraph 175. They were sent back to prison to serve out their terms, and time served in a concentration camp didn't count toward their sentences.
That's insane.
It is insane.
Insanity.
It is insane. Of course, cruel and unusual punishment. It never would have been in America. But, yes, they did continue afterwards because they really didn't see much. When the Jews were liberated, they were still hated also. Mm-hmm. But they were at least set free if they weren't murdered on their way back to their hometowns. But homosexuals were still considered criminals. They didn't change that law until many, many years later.
In 1978, it was repealed in East Germany, in 1979 in West Germany. But then the people who had served out their terms weren't pardoned by the German government until 1993.
That's a scary. Isn't this scary?
No, 2002.
Oh, was it 2002?
2002 was before they were all pardoned.
Okay.
Yeah, in 1985, that's when they abolished. 1985, 40 years after the liberation in World War II, then they abolished paragraph 175. But it wasn't until 2002 that they pardoned all those who had been convicted of homosexuality during any of those previous years ever. You know, so you think, golly, what world were we living in?
Well, we didn't get a Lawrence v. Texas decision from the United States Supreme Court until 2003.
So. Well, that's true.
Which eliminated the anti-gay laws in this country that allowed people to say, well, you're a criminal, so you can't be a school teacher. Mm-hmm. You know, and all of those things. And it happened to be Texas's sodomy law. And today in our state legislature, for the umpteenth time since 2003, they won't even remove it from the penal code in the book.
Really?
They won't. It's like symbolically there. They like it. It's just like the folks in D.C. who say, we want to repeal the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, because we want to make it illegal for gay people to be in the military. It's still out there. It's still out there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's amazing to me that we're still dealing with this.
Well, it is, unless you read all of the newspaper. Then you see that there's so many different people and that there's just so many discriminated. That's why I think, thank you for letting me be here today, because the Dallas Holocaust Museum is so important to this community. We have such rich cultural experiences. There's no question our arts community is so evolved. But when it comes to matters of the conscience, we need something like the Dallas Holocaust Museum that allows people to come in and talk about all those things that are about hatred, about bigotry, about indifference, and about being a bystander. Being indifferent is actually a choice. It's you're just as guilty of indifference as you are of bigotry.
And you had mentioned the arts community, and before you mentioned the cabarets, and you were involved in Dallas Theater Center's production of Cabaret. She starred as
I starred. I was Sally Bowles. I wasn't.
Wow.
Kate, I wasn't. I would have liked to have been. It was the Dallas Theater Center's most incredible performance ever, as I understand it. I hope somebody calls in. Lee Troll, who is with the Dallas Theater Center, starred as Cliff Bradshaw, who was in this production an American who came over. You know, in the movie, it was a British guy whose name I can't remember and who care. But Lee played Cliff, and he also facilitated the Q&A after every performance. And so the museum, myself, or my education director, Kathy Chapman, went to every single of 35 performances and talked about what it meant. Because it was such an intense play, and almost many of the performances of the 35 were sold out. The response was overwhelming.
Wow.
And we would have, they said they usually would average 20 to 50 people that would stay for talkback. We would have 100 to 200. There's only 400 to 450 in the audience, and they would stay, and they, because the final scene was riveting. It was not like the movie. In the final scene of this, there's a big boom and a curtain falls, and the back half of the stage, all the previous cabaret dancers and singers are naked with their backs to the audience with ashes falling from the ceiling, like
oh
the Holocaust.
Gosh.
And on the other half of the stage where the cabaret had been performing is a Nazi dancing with a prostitute with New Year's Eve hats on their heads and kissing and making out while these people are on the other side of the stage. And you're just kicked in the gut. And so people do want to stay, and they would talk, and they would give me the opportunity to say, you know, what was this? This is 1931. This is right before the Holocaust and before Hitler becomes chancellor in 1933. And then the Weimar Republic, everything goes. There's no censorship, and the cabarets are rampant, you know, and drugs and sex and the decadence. And it builds to an incredible crescendo, in fact, before Hitler just lowers the boom, and that's, and Joel Farrell directed it so magnificently. He that was his ending, and I hate to sound too proud, but they all came to the Dallas Holocaust Museum a few weeks before they opened, and that's when I'm told Joel got the vision to end it that way, because they spent a half a day in the exhibit and talking to two of our German survivors, asking them questions, and they all acted from a place of passion, of love. It changed my whole opinion of all actors, because they would come out every night after they changed out of their clothes, and they would have on their upstander wristbands, and would talk, and they would cry about how important it was to them to act in this play that it had. They hoped that it could. It's too bad it doesn't travel, because it was that kind of message that the audience received. About the first act was just about fun and games and doing whatever, you not caring about the world. And the second act, it all just came to a roaring halt, and nobody had rights anymore, and they just weren't paying attention. We all have to pay attention all the time. We have to be diligent all the time.
It's scary to me that this could happen again if we don't pay attention.
It does happen again. I mean, that's what happened in Sudan.
Oh, everywhere.
That's what, and right now, the Congo is the deadliest place on earth. Mm. Yes, I mean, even China, I mean, it does happen still. And when we recognize that and how close we are to those people, when I see what George Clooney and John Prendergast do for the Sudan and how important that is to them, it doesn't have to be. You know, they understand somebody has to stick up for these people who can't defend themselves.
So they're celebrity upstanders.
Yes, there's a lot of them, thank God.
And Alice, I want to thank you for being here today.
I you know, this is my pleasure. I wish you would let me do this every Wednesday at 7 a.m.
Well, maybe not. Come back.
I would love
to. The exhibit is Nazi Persecution of Homosexuals, 1933 to 1945. The museum is open 7 days a week. It's in the West End at West End Station in downtown Dallas.
And you can find it online at
DallasHolocaustMuseum.org.
And this is the part of our program where our producer, Thomas Pearson, disavows any knowledge of our existence. We'll be back with more of Lambda Weekly next week.
For listening to the KNON Morning Line, we'd like to remind you that the views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of the staff or management of KNON 89.3 FM.